Blog Talk Radio.
August 4th, 2020, and I'm your host, Tanya Hathaway, on Tanya Talks, where your voice is heard and your stories told on Marty Oakley's TS Radio Network and Stephen Burke's 89.9 KLRB Lighthouse Christian Radio out of Oklahoma. So thank you both to Marty, of course, for all of your shows. Marty Oakley, of course, is the producer of TS Radio Network with a whole bunch of shows every week. So you might want to do a little bit of research and see what else she produces and also what she hosts in. There's ppjg.me, ppjg.me. To take a look. And that way you can also get reminded of our regular shows that are on Tuesday and on Tuesday nights and on Sunday nights, which is a little separate from the one where Tina and I jump on live every other Thursday night, and it'll be this Thursday night. So keep an eye on the Facebook page, Oklahomans Incarcerated, True Stories, and How They Got There, with Tina Gertz and myself co-hosting. And tonight we have Tina Gertz on with us, as well as with Arthur Bean. So they're going to tell you a little bit about themselves when they jump on in just a moment here after I've done my little spiel. And Melissa Hurry, unfortunately, is not able to make it with us tonight. There was something last minute, and so that was my fault. I should have checked in with her on that. She's just so amazing that I just put her in automatically, assuming she would be able to just jump right on with us, as she usually is able to, but unfortunately she's not able to, but she will be back. And we've been taking the time on Tuesdays to really focus on wrongful convictions. And we've concentrated most recently in the area of Lawton, Oklahoma, where there's, obviously there's a district court in Lawton, Oklahoma, and we have some very similar scenarios taking place, and we're going to get into that a little bit more. And we've got a couple of more shows that we're going to be doing on Lawton before we move on to some other districts. And one of them is going to be Tulsa District coming up very, very soon. It won't necessarily be just on wrongful convictions. It will also be on wrongful trials for other arenas, one of which is definitely a murder trial, but also it's going to be more on the same judge or judges and the prosecutor and certain attorneys or public defenders, where we're going to kind of circle back to Tulsa a bit. But before that, we've got a couple shows that we're going to have with some other areas of wrongful convictions as well. So we really have quite a full calendar, but Oklahomans Incarcerated, True Stories and How They Got There. Please be sure to follow that Facebook page, as well as Injustice in Oklahoma Exposed Facebook page, where you're going to get the most recent updates. And we overlap a little bit, but there's also a lot of sharing that's going on, and that's very, very important. So we need to just, you know, make sure that everybody knows what we're doing here and that we can all get on the same page and do everything that we can to make so many things that's wrong right. And I want to thank the people that are sharing information with us that are, and even to a certain degree, you know, helping put together these shows because of the fact that they, you know, they're bringing forward the information, you know, the family members that is able to, you know, provide certain documentation and to the vetting process, they come on and they join with us. So speaking of the vetting process, I'm not a lawyer. Arthur Bean, who's with us, is not a lawyer. Tina Gertz is not a lawyer. But we are advocates. We are, okay, I'll speak for myself. I'm an advocate. I'm a whistleblower. I do some reporting, some investigating, public speaking on this. And certainly I am your radio show host, but neither Marty Oakley, Stephen Burke, or myself can be held personally or professionally liable for any error of content. If there seems to be an error, please contact injusticeinoklahoma@gmail.com. We're not all that fancy, but we're just working on getting things done. injusticeinoklahoma@gmail.com. And if there's any content that is given that it needs to be corrected, if it does need to be corrected, that correction will certainly be made. Okay, so we will take your calls a little bit later on during the show. Give us 15, 20 minutes to get a little warmed up. But you can call in to 917-388-4520, 917-388-4520. And with that being said, I want to introduce Tina and Art. So, Tina, why don't you go first? I know you're certainly, we're radio show hosts, you're an advocate, you know, talk to us. Tell us who you are, what you're doing.
I am an advocate. I've been fighting for, against my husband's wrongful conviction for about 11 or 12 years now. And in the research that I've done and the more I see, the more I know needs to be exposed. So that's why I do this, and I want to make other people aware so change can happen.
Right. By doing that, it's changing other people's lives. It's empowering others. And
yes.
We put on a nice rally together. We're working on putting another one together when the COVID settles down.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be big.
It's going to be big. Going to be big. We've got some nice bracelets also for Oklahomans incarcerated, true stories and how they got there, for Journeys to Justice and Injustice in Oklahoma Exposed, which if you want to help spread the word, just be in touch. Just send messages. Check out the page. We'll be Tina's waiting for something actually from me and to put those out so that we can show our support, show your support, and awareness of all these things that are going on, and that's why you're listening, and that's why you're, you know, it might be for the first time, or you might just listen in regularly. So thank you, Arthur Bean, why don't
yes.
you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I work for Deborah Hampton, and she's an attorney out of Edmond, Oklahoma. I investigate and am a research assistant, and I take the law seriously, and that's my
job. You sure do. You're like a walking encyclopedia. I love talking with you. And there's one case where that was affiliated with a fairly well-known person. Do you want to just share with our audience what that case was all about, or if you can, if you're allowed to.
Which case?
I know.
Which case?
Which is good. I love it. There's just so many because you're really making things go right. I'm trying to think the name
the
of the
federal
gentleman.
Lawsuit.
I think it was the federal lawsuit.
Well, we've definitely so Comanche County is sitting on Indian land, so a lot of those people down there in Comanche County, they're going to qualify for relief too.
Right, that's the majority.
Even Stanley
right.
Watson's probably going to qualify for relief. I think he's a Native American.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think.
And
I
even if your victim, even if your victim was an Indian.
Right. Right. Right, and we're going to get into that just a little bit after we talk about the Lawton cases. So, okay, let's talk about the wrongful convictions in Lawton. All right, that we're aware of. Okay, that we've dug a little bit deeper into. We've the Mike Gaines. That's one of them, right?
And honestly, I think Mike Gaines might even be Indian too, because if you look at some of the things to do with the name Gaines, you can trace it back into Native American history. He may even be entitled to some relief under that too.
So we're talking Stanley Watson. We're talking about Mike Gaines, and if it was on, doesn't have to be okay. So this is why don't you explain to our listeners what you are referring to for those that don't know it.
On the Indian claims.
Yes.
McGirt versus Oklahoma, Murphy versus Royale, that upset the state. That's going to be a game changer for the way they do things.
Right.
While the Attorney General don't want to admit it right now, it's going to be a game changer.
And so the Supreme Court made the ruling to enforce the Native American land. And so what that means, and feel free to interrupt, interject, but what that means is that if you or one of the litigants were Native American, or isn't it also even if it happened on Native American land?
No, it has to happen on Native American land, Indian land.
But what if it happens and you're on their land, but you're not Native American? It would still pertain.
Did you kill
it?
A Native American person, or is your victim Native American? Because it's going to apply then.
If the victim is Native American.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, what if the victim is not Native American?
And the person's not Native American, then it doesn't apply to you.
So
the state had jurisdiction.
Say there's a perpetrator that's Native American.
Uh-huh.
Why wouldn't it apply?
That's what I'm saying. If your victim's Native American, it's going to apply.
Right, but
if it works
for the defense, why wouldn't it be for the victim as for the perpetrator as well?
Well, the perpetrator is the defendant, right?
But that's the defense. I'm saying the other way around. So either way, it will be tried.
Well, if it's within the statute of limitations, but if it's murder, there is no statute of limitations.
Right.
For them to bring claims against them, the Attorney General said, well, there's not going to be no get-out-of-jail-free card. Well, the government's not going to prosecute them if the state deprived them of jurisdiction.
Right.
And Comanche County's sitting down on a reservation, too.
Okay, so say you're in a casino, right? And
uh-huh.
You've got two non-Native Americans in a casino on
uh-huh.
Indian land, right? All right, and they get into
uh-huh.
a fight. And they wind up, busting up a lot of property of the casino.
Uh-huh.
All right, where's that going to be tried?
Well, that very well could be tried in a federal court. Depends upon how much the damage is going to be, and depends on. Okay, look, it also depends on whether there would be if it would fall under the General Crimes Act, because if it also depends if it would fall under that crime, the General Crimes Act. But I think it could be prosecuted in federal court.
Okay. All right. Somebody steals a car. That's Grand Theft Auto. So that would be federal. But not necessarily.
Not necessarily. It depends.
Right.
There has to be a crime enumerated. I mean, because some of the general crimes are not going to, you know, well, it depends if there's something enumerated, like under the federal enclave laws, if whether it would apply to that offense. But anything under the General Crimes Act, if it's Native American, then the state would have jurisdiction. But under the general crimes, like the Major Crimes Act and the General Crimes Act are two separate statutory provisions. One's for murder, kidnapping, rape, assault and battery with a deadly weapon, your violent offenses, anything that would be a major crime. Now, the general crimes is totally different. Now, if you've got a Native American that committed a general crime that would fall under that statute, and you got two Indians, and the two Indians are the victims to this crime, then the state still has jurisdiction to prosecute them according to the statute.
Okay. Okay. All right, so let's work our way backwards and then come back to this a little bit, okay? So, all right, let's go back to Lawton, Mike Gaines, Stanley Watson. We've got another. Oh my goodness, we've got another two that we know we're coming on with over the next few weeks. Starting next Tuesday, we have got. Let me see. I'm just looking up for the name of one of them that I just need to vet just a little bit more, need to learn a little bit more about. And that happens to be a crime of passion case. And that crime of passion, let me see. Looking it up. Bear with me. Let me see. The name of this is. What is his
name?
Did
you say West?
West. Yes. Apparently, this also involves a similar name is coming up once again. Ken Sue Dorfel. I've been saying Dorsey quite a bit, but forgive me. The name is actually Ken Sue Dorfel. So, and she's an attorney. Right there in Lawton, if you want to call her that. But they're saying that he has been railroaded, taken advantage of, and he was given a life sentence when it's the understanding that a crime of passion usually holds the weight of 10 to 20 years. According to his email, his attorney, who I believe, again, is Ken Sue Dorfel, tricked him into signing away his life. And that would not be the very first time that has happened. He's filed for commutations, and he has been denied. And this person is saying she's at a loss as to the reason why, because he would be a perfect candidate for a commutation. So,
is the underlying crime of passion offense, is it manslaughter or second degree murder?
Manslaughter.
And he pled guilty?
Well, see, I haven't, this just recently came to me, so I have not had time to look it up, but the information is coming into me. So that's a disclosure. But if his attorney is who, you know, is Ken Sue Dorfel, then he probably pled guilty and for a promised more lenient offense. When the case is that's not the case, which, again, all this needs to be confirmed, but this would be following just another pattern when it comes to Ken Sue Dorfel as the attorney, because it's a state. Let me see. It is the state against him. So I imagine she was the defense attorney. So I know that she's done that to others, you know, so it wouldn't be the first time. So it just depends on who, what other players are involved and what the deals, you know, need to be. You know, it's kind of funny. I look up Ken Sue Dorfel, and it was back in 2014. She supposedly was working on reform, you know, on criminal reform. You know, it's just what really scares me is how there are bad actors that can, you know, that plant themselves in such places and design themselves to be people that actually would warrant, you know, to be in that kind of position when they actually belong behind bars, more than likely. So it's pretty scary. It's pretty darn scary. Yeah, I'm looking up another case with her, Tibbetts versus State, that she's involved in. So anyway, so we've got that case that we'll be looking more into. Also, Melissa Hurry has been talking with someone for some time now, is very, very well versed with a case that I believe you're familiar with as well. All, you know, we're talking about Lawton, Oklahoma. So what is it about, you know, Lawton, Oklahoma, or this is just, as we know, what happens when we find bad actors? All of a sudden people start speaking, and then other people come pouring in with their stories. What do you think?
Well, that's usually what happens. Look at Ada, Oklahoma, for example. Can't escape that story.
Right. Right. That's John Grisham.
Yeah, Williamson and Fritz. You got Perry Lott, Fontenot and Ward. There's going to be some more people. There's going to be some more wrongful convictions uncovered, too, from there.
Right. Right.
If the people ain't already died that they put in prison.
Right. Right. And there's two that are have life sentences also that happen to know Perry Lott, because they were in the same institution as well. So it's amazing, like, what a small world it really is, isn't it?
Yeah. When
so
you read the book of John Grisham. When you read that book, listen, when you read that book of John Grisham, you'll see how the conviction unfolds. I mean, how the stories unfold. And so when you see a wrongful conviction in one county, like look at Tulsa and the wrongful convictions they've had up there, all of them got the same players. The only thing that changes is the defendant.
Exactly.
Because that
exactly.
Power is a power trip with the DAs.
Right. Kurzweiler. He's been there forever. Kurzweiler, whatever his name is, he's been there
uh-huh.
just about forever. Mm-hmm. Federal Bureau of Prisons, as of June 2020, 157,862 inmates. 14,714 federal inmates in privately managed facilities. Boy, I wonder how many of those are in Oklahoma. Let's see. 9%, 14,452 in other types of facilities. So let's see, in Oklahoma, and this is according to the Department of Justice right now, Tina, you had forwarded other more specific to Oklahoma, but let me see. see, all regions, Oklahoma, let's generate that. Okay, El Reno, FCI, 894 in El Reno. El Reno Camp, 189. Oklahoma City, 598.
And that's at the transfer center.
Okay. That's what's pending.
Yeah, that's at the Oklahoma City Transfer Center.
Okay. Okay. Oh, my goodness. So,
that's
and there, are they just being held up there right now because of the COVID? Nobody knows where to put them?
Probably. But they're overcrowded, too.
They're overcrowded, too. Okay. So, you know what the number one problem is why people are in jail?
Rogue prosecutors.
Drugs. Yeah. let it rip. Yeah. Prosecutors.
Yeah.
If you're,
if you're
in one of these counties. Okay, throughout the country.
Yeah.
Throughout the country, we have got, let me see, I'm going to look at some others. All right, we'll look at inmate race, okay? White is 57%, black is 38.3%. Native American is 2.3%. Asian is 1.5%. Offenses throughout the country. Yeah, number one is drug offenses. And then we've got number two is weapons, explosives, and arson. And then we've got number three is burglary, larceny, property offenses. No, number three is extortion, fraud, and bribery. Okay, so that's a white collar. Then we've got burglary, larceny, property offenses. And then we have got, sex offenses is up there too. Immigration. Oh, goodness gracious. Homicide, aggravated assault, and kidnapping offenses. That is number, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That is the 6. Okay, 3.3%. 3.3%. What do you think that is in Oklahoma? on the record, not in the on the record.
What the incarceration rate is in Oklahoma?
Well, for what do you think the number one reason for incarceration is?
Well, it would be hard for me to believe that it's drugs right now since they reclassified those offenses. And if we're reading statistics about drug offenses, that's probably not an accurate accurate count right now.
Well, for the Department of Justice, it was updated across the country in June 30th. So it's a little more than a month old. But let's talk about that. Let's talk about changing the misdemeanors to felonies. And how about the felonies?
Yeah, we need to do that through the court, too. Now, think about this. That wasn't reform, okay? Because they let out 450 on one day, and you had 700 and something waiting to go to prison at that time, which you had double the number you just let out. So you can tell your citizens that we're reducing the prison population, but you haven't. And then to give the executive branch the authority to commute those sentences based upon a statutory change in penalty. it's not only a statutory change in penalty, it's a statutory change in the offense from a felony to a misdemeanor. The only way that they can change or alter that offense is in the court. So the people are allowed to maintain the felony conviction. So when the legislature says, we're going to go back in and we're going to change the law again, and so they take away, they make it where they can use all those felony convictions to prosecute you again. They haven't done nothing. You haven't done anything to corrections. Right now, as of yesterday, there were 1,510 inmates waiting to be transported to the prison system from county jails.
Wow.
They shut down Cimarron Correctional Facility. That takes away approximately 1,600 beds. They're going to move.
Now let's talk about why that was shut down.
DOC said we're going to take away 500 offenders out of each private prison. No, no, no. The private prison said, no, we're not going to do that. We got a federal lawsuit pending against them that's made it to the August 2021 docket for trial. We're the first firm in 20 years to have a docket scheduled trial against DOC.
That's
and I
so
sincerely
huge.
Doubt that they move for summary judgment. But that prison has got a lot of violence in it. In 2015, there were 4 people killed there in one day, in one riot.
And that's what was reported.
It was 2 minutes long. Right. But it was 2 minutes long. There were a lot more injured, but four people died. It was a knife fight between the Irish mob and the UAB.
Mm-hmm.
If they close that down, that moots our claims against Cimarron Correctional Facility.
That
if that's
the
case,
claim?
They're going to have to close down all the private prisons.
Well, they need to be closed down. They're not under the same. They're not being watched the same way.
I reasonably expect the private prison company will probably send somebody after me to kill me.
You, what did you say?
I reasonably expect somebody in the private prison sector to probably come to kill me.
Why? Because you're going to say something? Don't say it then.
Well, look what I'm doing to their – I mean, so they're going to contract with the federal government now in Oklahoma City. Let's talk about this. Every director, almost every director from the Oklahoma Department of Corrections, when they retire – where do they go to work? Private prison sector. They retire with a 6-digit figure for retirement. They go over to the private prison sector, and they're getting 6 digits a year there, too.
Right. Right.
So now you've got
and
at least
not,
$250,000 they're making
of
off of incarceration.
Route, not to mention their pocket money.
Uh-huh.
Nope, that's This is why it is so hard to get things done, is because as long as there's an incentive to not say anything or not do anything, these people are still mixed in the system somehow, and they're lining their pockets somehow, and that's why this needs to be the beginning of a new generation of what is lawful. And take them down one by one. No, I listen. It was Oklahoma. It was Oklahoma City that that prison there. They were supposed to be under federal watch temporarily, right? But they never let them in. Or at some point they wouldn't let them in. They said no. They turned them away. Gee, why is that?
Lots to hide.
At the federal prison?
Yeah. No.
I think that was
the feds were overlooking. Right, Tina?
Yeah, the feds were trying to get into a state prison. I can't remember which one.
Yep, it was one in Oklahoma City. It was a state prison because they had been basically sanctioned or, you know, they were found to be unable to properly run the prison. And so basically they were under watch. They were supposed to be allowed to walk in there anytime they wanted. And that wasn't happening. And that kind of disappeared, didn't it, Tina?
The state doesn't want the federal government coming in and looking and seeing what they're doing.
They got rid of the ACA when Robert Patton come in.
And what? Okay, can you explain more on that?
Well, that's kind of like an oversight. That's kind of like an oversight for the prison system, right? And they got to report violent incidents.
Right.
They got to report. Every area of corrections is monitored through the ACA because you have somebody writing reports. Like for the Department of Corrections, you might have a regional director that writes and reports and audits the prison system and see how it's running. But now they got an agency which is operating checks and balances on itself. There's no oversight with accreditation from the American Correctional Association. That was one of the things that they implemented in Bobby Battles' case, Battles versus Anderson. That litigation went on for 27 years and until 1999 when they finally come to an agreement with Battle. And that was the whole reason that they'd even proposed the sentencing matrix and truth in sentencing. But yet when they reached an agreement with Battle, the legislature – it was supposed to go into effect in 1998. They extended the effective date until 99. You hear a lot of inmates say, well, too many people were filing lawsuits over it already. I disagree because they reached an agreement with Battle. Within 7 days after they reached that agreement, they repealed the Truth in Sentencing Act. After they, in the agreement, agreed to uphold and honor the agreement, they completely quashed the agreement when they paid Battle's attorney. So that left life sentences at till you die. That's when you discharge a life sentence for the natural remainder of your life. And so your stance on hard on crime.
Where it used to be 40 years, didn't it?
No.
What was it?
No. Only for purposes of the consideration of parole is life considered 45. That's all.
Okay.
You used to be able to come up for parole after 15 years. But now, since 1999, it was you got to do 38 years.
Okay. You have to do 30. Okay. All right. And that's, of course, what we're trying to change, right? That's what you're working to change. In the 85% Act?
Yes.
You there? Okay.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Well, I'm looking right now under the DOC, OK.gov, Oklahoma Corrections Accreditation and Commission on Accreditation for Corrections of private nonprofit organizations which administer the only national accreditation program for all the components of adult and juvenile corrections. The purpose of the organizations is to promote improvement in the management of a voluntary accreditation program and ongoing development and revision of relevant, useful standards. Oh boy!
In Oklahoma, don't have any of that no more. Patton let it go. Patton let it go because
and yet they still have the website up.
Patton called those people out of the county jails that were waiting to go to prison. Ordered all of them out. and they filled up these day rooms in these medium prisons, which that in, that put a strain on the corrections. There were some inmates that filed a lawsuit against them on that overcrowding, because that does lead to imminently dangerous conditions right there.
Right.
He started to make some headway with the litigation.
I just hit a link and that was closed. So, all right. So that's so that's where, once again, we've got the conviction integrity unit very much in need.
But listen to this. So even those people that are wrongfully convicted, if we define what life sentences are and we get a sentencing matrix, even if they don't never get no relief from the court, they at least get an out date from prison. They at least get to be released from prison. And if you meet your mandatory, this is what I'm going to propose to the state, that if the state wants to say this is your assessed needs, that you need anger management, thinking for a change, MRT, a GED, whatever they assess on you, you meet that, but yet when you come up for parole, guess what? Denied. So it's all discretionary. Yeah. So what are those plans for? What are those plans of incarceration?
It's just a way to funnel money to other people.
Right. It's not corrections.
Right. It's not corrections.
It's not corrections.
It's lining pockets.
Right.
No. And why is it that there's no more reasoning behind a denial of a commutation anymore or parole? Which is that?
Well, then let me tell you why there never was, and let me tell you the reason why. Because if they put – number one, there's an Oklahoma Administrative Procedures Act under Title 75 where there's two parts, mm-hmm. okay? There's part one, which is a quasi-legislative part, which the Pardon and Parole Board is not exempt from. And then there's Article 2 provisions, which is a quasi-judicial function in the administrative branch. Oklahoma Pardon and Parole Board is exempt from that. If they had to give reasons for denials, they could actually create a liberty interest in that policy, because it might give the offender the right to challenge any decision.
Absolutely, as it should be.
As it should be, but they're not going to take that bounds and step over the line, because they want to be able to end a lawsuit before it ever starts.
Right.
By saying,
I mean,
you don't have a liberty
frankly,
protected
there
interest.
There should be a checklist. There should be a checklist, you know? I'm nothing for nothing, but it's like you equate it to a talent. Competition, right? Well, was the person poised?
Right.
Yes. Was the person, did they have a true this? Did they have this? That, the other thing, you know, I mean, terrible comparison. So, you know, you jump on in here. But, you know, there should be a checklist, not just discussion amongst, you know, the panelists, you know, so to speak. But it should be, okay, did this person this? Did they do that? Have they been written up for anything? And you know, do they did they get their GED? Are they following with the requirements? And it should never have. Do you admit that you did the crime? Because there's too many that have been wrongfully convicted. That should never be part of the questions. And yet, it's my understanding that that question does happen to come up, and it, God forbid, you say, no, I didn't commit that crime, you're probably automatically
they
rejected.
Want people to take responsibility for their actions, but if you say I didn't do it, then you're not taking responsibility, but you really didn't do it, and there's no way around that. It's like
just like some of these cases that go to trial, there's a reason why these guys go to trial. I say there's three reasons. There's three reasons. Either the guy is innocent and he cannot bring himself within his own constitution to say, I'm guilty of this crime that I didn't commit. He can't do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Number two is that they're facing a buttload of time And the prosecutor comes at him and says, well, I want you to take 50 years. And you say no. And then they take you to trial.
Mm-hmm.
And a jury gives them every bit of 50 years.
Right.
And number three is that they're just plumb idiots.
They're just going to fight it. Yeah.
But you're right. I think it's Stanley Watson, I believe, that he was offered 3 years and has been in for 20-something. And
he's argued DNA testing.
Yeah.
And he's argued DNA testing. And I truly believe Stanley may be innocent.
Yeah. Me too.
I wanted to argue that DNA statute because the way that but we got something pending in the Tenth Circuit right now, waiting for a determination if Oklahoma's post-conviction DNA testing statute's unconstitutional. Because I argue that there's a provision in it which gives which allows for an abuse of discretion. For an arbitrary abuse of discretion when reviewing these petitions to allow the district courts to abuse their discretion when denying it. And so what's reviewable into the appellate court is an abuse of discretion. So if there's a discretionary mechanism to allow the abuse of discretion,
my goodness, then you've got a new reason to appeal.
Then it's unconstitutional.
Right.
You can have a review based upon.
You can only appeal if there's new. I'll ask for a new trial if there's new information.
Hmm.
You can only ask
and if you
for a new
never...
trial if there's new information, and if what this argument is before that you're arguing in front of the 10th district, right? Then if that were, then that opens up the opportunity for that abuse of discretion to be used.
And that provision in the statute is that there would be a reasonable likelihood that the outcome of the trial would have been different. So district attorneys and the district courts repeatedly use this provision to deny relief. And they always say, well, there's not a reasonable probability that the outcome of the proceedings would be different.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like charging a defendant with one count premeditated murder or in the alternative, felony murder.
So
charging
let me ask you something,
with both,
then.
Yeah.
Even if the DNA is disposed of, you can still go in with that argument then.
Well, if the DNA is disposed of, it depends on when they dispose of the DNA. Now, if it was before 2001, it may have been lawfully disposed of. But, I mean, if the guy went to trial, then I would certainly have to argue that it was a bad faith destruction of evidence under California versus Trumbetta or Arizona versus Youngblood. I mean, it's prejudicial to the defendant. You put the state on notice that you didn't plead guilty when you went to trial. They were on notice. Why did it destroy the evidence?
Right. Oh, right. No, that's...
But it's happened. It's happened. So one case out of Tulsa, 1988, the guy's trial attorney had submitted a motion for DNA testing, and, you know, the state appeared to testify and said that, you know, it was well beyond the pockets of the state. So it means that it cost too much. But beyond the pockets of the state really didn't mean that it cost too much according to the state. And then before the direct appeal was even affirmed, the DNA sample was disposed of. It was thrown away. And then years later, they say, well, it was disposed of by court order, but nobody ever produced the court order ordering its destruction.
Right.
Under the current statutes, for providing for the preservation of evidence, the evidence must be preserved for the remainder of the time a defendant remains incarcerated. If it's a violent offense or a sex offense, and he got over 25 years, he can petition for DNA testing. Now, I think limiting the amount of time that a defendant got you shouldn't say, well, you had to get 25 years or more in order to petition for DNA testing. That's unconstitutional too, in my opinion, because now you limit a restriction. If this man's in prison, he's no different than everybody else. Just because he got less than 25 years, he should still be able to petition for DNA testing. And that's why you need conviction integrity units, because now these conviction integrity units get familiar with what the violations are. Oklahoma, I don't think during my lifetime I'm going to see a conviction integrity unit in Oklahoma. And I say that I remain cautiously.
Because they're not going to be able to keep lying in their pocket.
Right, just like Mike Hunter can't agree with what the Supreme Court said. I mean, it's all within the language. It's all in the language of what the Supreme Court said in McGirt. He can't even agree.
Yeah, so he's interpreting it for the way that works for him.
Right,
because
so he can maintain
their whole revenue.
Right. Right. It's going to knock out oil and gas industry tax. And if the government goes after the marijuana business, bam, they're going to take that money too. That money's going to leave the state. Whoever's running the weed dispensaries and the groweries, they're going to have to take that stuff over onto state land, get it off federal land.
Right. Right.
And this whole smoke and mirrors.
I mean, that state has been run. The legal system there, the attorney general, last two attorney generals that have been good for nothing, and now we're looking at the same thing when it comes to Pretty Boy Stitt. It looks like, unfortunately, he didn't mind having his face in front of everybody while he was running, and he said everything right, He became that typical politician, and where is he now?
Let's renegotiate the compact because we need the money from your casino so we can pay you with the money.
All right, Tina, that's great. 917-388-4520. 917-388-4520. Press number 1 if you have a comment or a question.
I want you to
917-388-4520. Do you have a comment or question for Tina Gertz, for Arthur Bean, or for myself, your host, Tanya Hathaway?
Who do you know?
Yeah.
You're in the government. It's really not who you know. It's who you blow.
Okay, now we're on a Christian radio station.
Although the charges at issue in Murphy and McGirt arose in Creek Nation, on the Creek Reservation, there's nothing in either opinion to suggest that it only applies to the Creek Nation. Indeed, to put to rest any possible argument to the contrary, immediately after issuing those decisions in Murphy and McGirt, the Supreme Court vacated convictions of 4 other individuals in light of McGirt, ruling none of which had anything to do with the Creek Reservation. Johnson versus Oklahoma, Seminole Nation. Davis versus Oklahoma, which was Choctaw Nation. Terry versus Oklahoma, Ottawa Nation. Bentley versus Oklahoma, Citizens of Potawatomi Nation. His offense happened in Lexington, Oklahoma. Joseph Hart, all your prisons are pretty much on Indian land. So if you had a Native American person, an Indian, in the prison and he killed a cellie, the federal government had jurisdiction over that, but yet the state deprived them of the jurisdiction. Just like all the other cases. Now, in Greer County, you got Granite, OSR. That's not Indian land. Oklahoma City, that area up in Oklahoma City is not Indian land. The top part of Oklahoma, Enid, it's not Indian land. But now, if you've got an area that may be considered a dependent, yeah, Enid, but if you've got an area that is considered a dependent Indian community, that's going to be Indian land. Now, if they got it's casino up there. I think there's a casino up there by Enid, and that's going to be Indian land, because because those gaming operations can only be in Indian country, according to what the Attorney General's opinion was in relation to a question submitted by Michael Otter when he was in the legislature. He's kind of responsible for getting Indian gaming in Oklahoma. Because that question came back, Mike Lauder.
Okay.
When he was in the House, when he was in the House of Representatives.
Okay.
Now, it's my understanding. This is what
Justice Robert said. Listen to this. Maybe this will end any confusion. Not only does the court discover a creek reservation that spans 3 million acres and includes most of the city of Tulsa, but the court's reasoning portends that there are four more such reservations in Oklahoma. The rediscovered reservations encompass the entire eastern half of the slip opinion, page 46. Roberts dissenting. That was his dissent. In any event, any doubt remains whether McGirt applies with equal force to all five tribes. Mike Hunter explicitly stated it does on News 6 story on the hot seat. Attorney General Mike Hunter addresses McGirt versus Oklahoma. Prior to McGirt, courts sometimes face confusion regarding where to look to determine whether a particular reservation still existed, but McGirt put any such confusion to bed. To determine whether a tribe continues to hold reservation, there is only one place we may look: Acts of Congress. In McGirt, Gorich wrote, "To be quite fair, Oklahoma is far from the only state that has overstepped its bounds." Now, that's bigger than Oklahoma.
That's huge.
That's bigger than McGirt.
But is there any action that's being taken to enforce in these other states?
I don't know yet. I've tried to post McGirt versus Oklahoma in some other pages that have focus inmates in those other states, and my posts have been rejected.
Really?
Yeah, I'm trying to publicize it and get it out there because these inmates need to know. Like, you got Michigan, you got South Dakota, North Dakota, you got all these other states that have Indian land in them. It ain't
right.
Just Oklahoma.
Oh, right. But Oklahoma is the one that was sought out after for enforcing.
And Hunter says, yesterday, that it only applies to Creek Nation. The Supreme Court didn't say. Well, I think the Supreme Court did say.
Yeah, so he's just trying to interpret it his own way. Tina, what were you going to say?
It's my understanding that if somebody was sentenced to 20 years in prison and they're Native American and now they can appeal to get it overturned because of jurisdiction, that if they get retried in federal court and a jury sentences them to 20 years, they have to serve the whole 20 years, even though they've already served 10. Is that correct?
Well, what's the offense?
Well, I'm just saying, I don't know. I'm just
it's going to matter what the offense is. If it's murder, then there's no statute of limitations on prosecuting murder. If it's kidnapping and the guy's in state custody, you know, and you vacate the conviction, is the federal government going to come after him? I mean, hell, because the government knew that he committed a crime, right? The government knew it. The government could have brought charges against him because the Oklahoma government brought charges against him. So Oklahoma acted as an impediment for bringing a case against the guy for kidnapping. And if the statute of limitations is, you know, arson has a statute of limitations. The only crime, murder, no statute of limitations. So
not
they could prosecute somebody convicted of murder, you see?
Mm-hmm.
But not anything that had a statute of limitations that had lapse. Let's take child sexual abuse, lewd molestation. So if you prosecute the guy, so the statute of limitations don't begin to run until the child turns 18.
Mm-hmm.
So you got seven years to bring the claim, right?
Well, that's been opened up again in that. Well, that's opened up. That's different in every state now, but I know that it's opened up for like Boy Scouts, right?
But we're not talking about other states right now. We're talking about the federal government.
Right. No,
we're talking
about
the United States Code.
Right.
Because if we're talking about prosecution in federal court, those state laws don't apply.
Right. And that's a good thing, I suppose, in most cases.
Mm. Well, there's a matrix, there's a sentencing matrix, but depends on, you know, is there going to be an upward departure? But then, you know, you get to look at it like this. If the federal government was to prosecute all them people that the state would have to release, that's going to even do more to their system of corrections.
Mm-hmm.
Hunter said, McGirt's not going to be a get-out-of-free-jail card, y'all, because we're hard on crime. Well, I think McGirt versus Oklahoma is a get-out-of-jail-free card for a lot of inmates, despite what he says.
Yeah, and some of that might be good, and some of that might not be so good.
Well, let's just maybe use it for population control if that happens.
Right.
Like the coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, you can't discriminate based on who you think is really deserving of it or not. It either applies or it doesn't.
Right.
So why is he going to try to fight them if it either applies or it doesn't?
Well,
Mike Hunter
I guess
said
so.
He was going to fight every appeal. So
okay, he's going to fight every appeal.
But
so let me
ask you
this. So,
yeah, that's
like
an awful lot of money.
What is
that's
thought
a good
process? They spent who knows how many dollars convicting these people. Who knows how much money keeping them in prison for longer than federal sentencing would do. They're going to have lawsuits against them for wrongful incarceration. But he's still going to fight?
That's a whole other story, the whole wrongful incarceration thing.
Let me tell you why he's fighting it. I tell you why he's fighting it, because if he concedes, he's got to stop taxing that oil and the gas trade that goes through those other tribal lands.
Gotcha.
And he want to make it seem like the Indians even had a right to negotiate. The Indians didn't have a right to negotiate and come to an agreement, only to produce to Congress, only to present to Congress. Congress needs to be their own decision maker.
For those that are listening, for the purposes of wrongful convictions or excessive sentencing, this is something especially to really pay attention to with what's going to be coming up, and to subscribe to, you know, staying informed, because there might be actions that you should be taking that you're not aware of in order to help your loved one or loved, you know, and their case. They're wrongfully convicted or not. You know, whether they're wrongfully convicted or not, because this doesn't apply necessarily to just wrongful convictions. This just applies in general where it applies.
Right. Right.
So that's why I'm saying, you know, some of these, you know, we could be very pleased with, and some of them maybe not so pleased with, but
mm-hmm.
the point is, if they messed up, they messed up.
Mm-hmm.
Would you live next door to somebody if you knew they had committed murder?
Would I live next door to somebody if I knew they committed murder? Boy, oh boy.
Would that be uncomfortable for you?
It honestly, it would depend on the case. It would depend on their circumstances. Manslaughter, first degree murder. You know what I mean? It would really depend on the type of, you know, the circumstances surrounding it.
What if even though he was charged, convicted of first degree murder, doesn't mean he's a murderer anymore? What happens to serve your time? Never done. Do you know what I mean? If you're convicted of first degree murder, everybody's going
to see
you as a murderer.
I would live next to Stanley Watson. I would. You know what I mean? I would live next. Well, they're wrongfully convicted. But you know, but like what they're in there for? Even if like, I mean,
so do you think the Department
I would live next door to one
doesn't reform?
It really just depends on, like, if I knew, you know, if there was a habitual, you know, rapist or murderer or you know, that they keep on releasing for, you know, the ones that get by, the ones that for some reason, you know, then I'd be scared. I wouldn't want to, and I'd be upset with, why is that person out here on the road? I'd be upset if there was, you know, a drunk driver out there, you know, constantly on the road. I had kids, you know what I mean? So it really, and nobody's doing anything about it, and there's negligence in the system because of that, and there's nobody's doing the reform, no, you know what I mean? It really just depends case. I wouldn't, you know, there's some things that we don't have the right to know, and there's some things that we do have to know, and I think that, you know, people need to make their own decisions, but I want to make them based on the truth, not based on wrongful convictions, excessive sentencing, the court of public opinion. You know, I'm an advocate and a bleeding heart through and through, which means, do I feel sorry for a victim? Absolutely. And sometimes those victims, many times, far too often, those victims are the ones that are behind bars, and their families are victims.
Right.
So it's a very, you know, so we just cannot, you know, just have automatic judgment. That's the thing.
Exactly.
You know, these across the board answers, supposedly, they should never be across the board. It should never be across the board. Every situation is different. And that wouldn't lend itself to, that means that you can just basically come up with a reason why this situation is different, and you can't and find the reasons to justify something that's out of the ordinary. I don't mean it to work that way, but every case needs to be handled in a way where, number one, all the evidence gets put forth and it's not squashed out. You know, it's not suffocated, and that's what happens. That's why we have these wrongful convictions. exculpatory evidence isn't let in.
Mm-hmm.
You've got
mm-hmm.
Public defenders and even, you know, defense attorneys that are corrupt. And that's why these things are happening. So you don't know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So you could automatically have a judgment on somebody because of what you read, because
mm-hmm.
what a finding was, the people don't deserve.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this is about. You know, if we know the
mm-hmm.
truth, then we can make really good decisions and decide and make our decisions how we really feel about something. But the problem is we're not allowed to know the truth. The general population, you know, does not know the truth because you've got those heavy hands and of corruptors out there that are making sure that you don't know the truth. And that's where we have to stop. And that's why we can't just automatically come to judgment.
Mm-hmm. I agree 100%. Telling Tommy the other day, in this day and age where nobody wants titles on them or, you know, labels, that's exactly what we do to people who are incarcerated. When they come out, they're felons, they're this, they're that. And that label sticks with them forever. And it... what?
Oh, he's talking about that. No. You're talking about that, but I met a guy today that tells me that he pled guilty to failure to register as a sex offender. I said, well, he said, but I've never been convicted of a sex offense.
What?
And I said, but you pled guilty to it. I said, well, why did you plead guilty to it? He said, well, because my lawyer told me I could get out of jail if I pled guilty to it.
Oh, my gosh.
Then he got a letter from the Department of Corrections that said that he didn't have to register as a sex offender. But he's still paying the fines for the failure to register.
Oh, my gosh.
Only in Oklahoma.
Railroaded.
Huh? Only in Oklahoma.
Oh,
dude, he never even been to prison. He don't even got a DOC number for the state. So, I don't know. I told him that I'd had to look at the information to see where they're alleging that this conviction came from. Had to go back and why didn't the lawyer investigate? And the lawyer is somebody with the Oklahoma Indigent Defense System. Why wouldn't I thought I used to respect her more than this, but why wouldn't she go and look? Why wouldn't she do a little bit of investigation? Just because the state charges with somebody with an indictment doesn't mean they're guilty.
Right.
That's right. Doesn't even mean that there's a case whatsoever in this case.
Yeah.
So I run the sex offender database. That go out there and prey on senior citizens. Well, let me call 50 of them and I'll get one out of 50. That's fine. This poor guy.
Yeah.
Sounds like he's, you know, sounds like the same thing. That's nuts.
Well, that's why you can't believe everything you see on the TV. The news is in such a rush to give you the latest breaking news, but they don't even have the whole story, and they're rushing you to judgment.
They're rushing you to judgment. Exactly. They're rushing you to judgment. I mean, look, did this guy actually – so now this guy has actually answered, so now they've got jurisdiction over him. But they never had subject matter jurisdiction to begin with, so that wins once it can be proven.
It's a crazy system.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
It's amazing what fear will do. What happens when, you know, you have been fear-mongered into something that you don't need to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like registering a sex offender, you've never even been convicted of a sex offense. Good Lord.
Oh, my gosh.
Crazy.
Oh, my word. That is something else.
That is something else. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit more about, let me see. Hold on. I've got a bunch of notes here. This is, okay, I've got a bunch of notes here. But I would really like to talk a little bit more about the misdemeanors to the felonies and just, you know, how that impacts. You know, because I know that we went through that, but that does not do any, there's no benefit for the inmates whatsoever or for those that are charged whatsoever.
Let's talk
about
this. So, right. Now, let's talk about what they did. What they did was they changed these drug possessions and some property crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. Well, the legislature had proposed, we're going to make this where these guys can bring it on a post-conviction application. And then I don't know if it was the governor that stepped in on that or the legislature just rewrote the statute, but it didn't come out that way. So what the governor did was put a team together to review those cases, and they started putting them on a special commutation docket to bring those guys up. To commute those sentences, you know, and that's where you got the biggest release in history, which was really nothing but smoke and mirrors. Now,
it really was, wasn't it? That was how many?
Yeah,
released?
Yeah, because you had like 450. I mean, even if you say 500, you had 800 waiting to go.
Yeah.
You had 800, 796 people in the county jails, and today you got 1,510. And no telling how much COVID's waiting to come to prison. I estimate by the end of next week, there'll at least be 1,600 or 1,700 people waiting to go to prison in them county jails.
Mm-mm-mm.
But now you've got
COVID
people
doing down in Oklahoma now.
It's not doing good, but you got people. Listen, you got people that are serving prison sentences that are enhanced by now what's misdemeanors. And they can't do nothing about those enhancements because, oh, guess what? The legislature didn't say they could. They didn't make a retroactive determination. Well, that statutory penalty and that statutory definition of what the fine is, that's a substantive change in law. That should have retroactive application. The original bill that they introduced was retroactive.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to ask the federal court to issue a mandate about it as part of the lawsuit, because if you could get some of them enhancements off them guys, it'd put them out. You got some guys right now that would discharge if those enhancements were them felony enhancements were misdemeanors.
Okay. Can you explain what the enhancements are to our listeners? Can you give an example?
Possession of marijuana. Possession of methamphetamine.
On top of another crime, correct?
On top of something else that would be deemed a felony.
Right.
You've got some people that may have 2, 3, 4 counts of possession, of simple possession, or a property crime. And now those offenses that are misdemeanors, they may have 4 or 5, and then they may have another offense which is enhanced by them 3 or 4 felonies that are now misdemeanors. But
because
the state didn't give them any.
Is that it?
Right, because they look at them as individual felony convictions,
mm-hmm.
according to the statutes. Where you take away some of those offenders might be entitled, they might be entitled to a suspended portion of their sentence once you take those felonies away.
Right. What do they just need? So many in the mill to make sure that they're not going to go broke? They all are lining their
pockets? What they need. This is what they need to keep those private prisons full. So those
read that.
So those
thing.
People
yeah.
could, yeah.
Right. That's exactly what you want.
And then
saying.
So, and then we, and look, and then housing them in the county jails incentivizes arrest when you house them in the county jails, because now that's driving incarceration, that's driving the need to incarcerate up for the sheriffs, so the state can, so they can make money off the sheriff's department. Well, if they can, I mean the state. So if the sheriff can contract with the state to house offenders, that's money coming into his jail. So that incentivizes those officers to go and find crime. Y'all get out there and fill up my jail up. I don't care whether they've committed a crime or not. Just bring them in.
Right. Just bring them in.
Yeah, because the county jails are making money off that when they're contracted. That should be unconstitutional.
Right.
The county jails. Look at the back in the look back.
It's a conflict
at the
of
beginning
interest.
Of statehood. It is.
Right.
Just like having a public defender in a smaller county. That's contracted
right.
with the Oklahoma Indigent Defense System. Just like having McCall on the Pardon and Parole Board violates the separation of powers of the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Everyone's getting paid by the same person. The paycheck is coming from the same place. They're in front of the same
right,
people.
But look, when we have the judiciary, the judicial system giving him a retirement, that's where his retirement comes from. And then he's appointed to a public body that their compensation comes from taxes levied against citizens. The board is an executive function of the government. How can you have two financial departments coming together as one? You know, so from the judicial system and the executive branch has an influential process with them. Coercive influences.
Absolutely.
So there's for McCall's demeanor. Let's lash out at Bickley, make him resign. So McCall just started a hostile work environment. Feel sorry for Bickley. I wish that we could get a grand jury investigation into what McCall knows about the crimes that he's alleging that Bickley perpetrated. Let's hear about this, because now McCall is guilty of a conspiracy. Oh, yeah, the good old boy system. Forgot.
Mm-hmm.
Corruption
now,
at its finest.
Just an article on McCall just like that came out today or yesterday? What's the new news there? Mm-hmm. McCall, who is
– I don't know. I haven't got to see it.
Okay. All right. Well, we're just getting ourselves a little bit caught up. What'd you say, Tina?
I was going to say I didn't see anything today, but I know McCall threatened the director, and then the director of the Pardon and Parole Board resigned because of threats made against him. And it's corruption at its finest. Mm-hmm. Because McCall has the backing of the DAs. And then,
because he was a judge.
Well, yeah, but they know if McCall's on the board, they got a no vote. The DA's got a no vote. Then you got Gilland, which he was out with COVID, fell and broke his hip, from what I understand. You got a no vote there. Then you got Morris, which was he's the first African American person to be a district supervisor over the probation for the Eastern District of Oklahoma. I kind of somewhat admire him, you know, he for his accomplishments. But if it's a violent crime, you probably pretty much got a no vote there because McCall and Gilland sway his vote because he's a judge. Everybody wants to appease the judge. Everybody addresses him as judge. He's McCall. He's Mr. McCall
right.
when he's on the board. He's not a judge no more. But because everybody wants to dignify him as your honor or judge, that, I mean, okay, he retired. Does he still have the right to be called judge? I don't think when he's on the pardon and parole board.
Not when he's acting on that in that position. No, absolutely not.
Right.
The judge has to come off.
Right, but those guys want to appease him and make him happy. So Adam Luck and Kelly Doyle, they don't matter about making him mad.
Right. Because they probably don't have any special privileges. They wouldn't anyway.
But
these are
honestly,
people of integrity.
But I honestly feel
Luck
like,
and
I'm going to say this. I'm going to say this. Now, I honestly feel like because of McCall's threats and his demeanor and the way that he acts, it's probably persuaded Luck and Doyle a couple of times to say no. I'm not going to swear to it, but their numbers came way down in voting. There had to be a reason why those numbers came way down in their recommendations. And was that because of McCall, like what he did to Bickley? I can't say that. I don't know. But there's some behind-the-stuff scenes going on, too.
So that would make you wonder.
Yeah. We did an open records request. I want all emails sent from McCall to the district attorneys. I haven't got a response back yet, but I did get all the emails from Bickley. I did get all the emails that Bickley and McCall had got.
And were they telling?
Yeah, I mean, really, with the way they were intimidating him. Those district attorneys are really opposed to granting relief to anybody. If the state could have it their way, they would just abolish the pardon and parole board. I wish they would. Mm-hmm. Abolish it. Take it away. And I say that for good reason, because then everybody's sentence is doing life becomes life without parole. So any juvenile serving one or two life sentences, guess what? They get relief eventually under Miller and Montgomery when the state abolishes the parole system. They effectively abolished it in 1999 when they enacted the 85% rule, because not one offender has been in front of the pardon and parole board serving a life sentence for consideration of parole purposes.
Not one offender has.
No, because you have to do 38 years. 38 in a couple of months, but 38 years before you get to see the board. And it was in 99 when they enacted it. There ain't been 38 years passed. So you've effectively abolished a parole system for anybody serving life violent crime.
And then, God forbid, you're wrongfully convicted.
Yeah, you never get out of prison. You're never going to get out of prison. But look, if you do this sentencing matrix, look, I mean, so Oklahoma don't have no faith in their correction system because it's a system of incarceration. That's all it is. I mean, sentencing, plans of incarceration mean nothing. Nothing to the state. Nothing to the parole board.
I just noticed we are out of time. We're actually out of time. I need to close this down. But this is why we're having these shows, and we're continuing on telling the truth with Oklahomans that are incarcerated, that are wrongfully convicted. So I just noticed we're out of time. I want to thank you for bringing this to a different level than I had expected tonight, Arthur Dean, Tina Gertz. And please do tune in on Thursday. Check us out on Injustice in Oklahoma Exposed and Oklahomans Incarcerated, True Stories of How They Got There. Arthur will be back on again to discuss more of the McCurdy. I'm Tanya Hathaway and the Indian and the American, the Native land. And sorry, I wish that I had brought more out in this section, but there was just so much to share to get caught up on in preparation for Thursday, and we'll be back on next Tuesday with more wrongful convictions. I'm Tanya Hathaway. I'm your host. Boy, this flew. Good night, everybody, and God bless.
Good night. Thank you.